All right, so I'm here once again with James Sino, and once again we're going to be talking about a very interesting passage in Chinese history. I mean, basically what we're talking about is the birth of the Chinese state as we know it, the birth of China. And I mean, a lot of people, when they think about China, they think of the Han. They say, well, these are the Han people and all this sort of stuff. But the actual history is a little bit more complicated because there's this prior state that existed, which was the Qin. Is that right?
Yes.
And there's also this, and correct me if I'm wrong, because this is your area, not mine, but I believe there's a little like an interregnum period between the fall of the Qin and the true establishment of the Han. There's this kind of little period in between. What's it called again? The
It's called
interregnum period,
the Chu Han Contention.
the Chu Han contention, and this is basically what we're going to be talking about here. But before we get going, I'll just remind people you can pick up Foundations of Shakespeare, pre-order it now. You should get it by March, April, I think, if you get it in. The reason I'm mentioning it now, though, is that if you have Foundations of Shakespeare, the course, you can send them a receipt and get 50% off this book. And currently, that course and all my courses are on sale with promo code SHORJAN, which gets you 25% off. And I worked out if you get the promo code, stick it on, the difference basically ends up getting you this almost for free. So, yeah, you can do that maths in your own time. So I'll play my ad. When we come back, we're going to talk about the Chu Han contention.
Sure. Sure. And so, sure.
Sure, Jan.
Can you command a comma like Joseph Conrad?
Sure.
And sure, Jan.
Are you magnificent in your mastery of marginalism like Murray Rothbard?
Sure.
Sure, Jan.
Are you legendary in your logical leveling of lamentable loquacity?
Sure.
Sure, Jan.
Come on down to the January sale at the Academic Agency. Promo code SHORJAN for
Sure, Jan.
25% off. All this January, I got more courses than the Queen had horses.
Sure, Jan.
I got better rates than Andrew Tate's ad mates.
Sure, Jan.
I got better deals than Lizzo's had meals.
Sure.
Sure, Jan.
And so, sure. And so, sure.
I slipped then, and we went on to a different ad. All right, so James, last time we talked about Lord Shang, and we talked about legalism and how that system came to fall. Today, you want to talk about, well, getting up to the point of the establishment of the Han dynasty, which is famous, the one that everybody talks about, is kind of synonymous with China. Take it away.
Well, I think this period known as the Chu Han Contention is overlooked for a very good reason. I think historians underestimate how and misunderstand how the Chinese state, known as the Han state, came into being, because they fail to realize that Liu Bang built around him a counter elite. And how that exactly came into place. And we've set the scene before with the unification of this geographic territory, the standardization of language, and we've talked about some factors as to why it fell.
So, sorry to interrupt, James. The person you mentioned, lots of people won't be able to just spell it out. Like, who is this person? Yep.
Okay, there are two key characters that I'm going to talk about. Liu Bang, who founded the Han Dynasty, Liu, Liubang, Liu Bang. He went by quite a few names, and that's the confusing factor for anyone
I'd say
studying
Liu
Chinese
Bang.
history.
Liu Bang, like he's in
Liu,
Mortal Kombat.
Liu. I'm not sure if it's the same character. I'd have to see. It may be. They were both certainly as tough as each other in some ways. Yeah. So this Liu Bang, who would eventually found the Han Dynasty, and the other character that I'll introduce was Xiang Yu, and now he was one of the nobles of the conquered state of Chu in the south. And I touched upon this a little bit earlier in the other video. He was the grandson of someone who died in the resistance. But he was someone, unlike Liu Bang, who could call to him people just off the back of his name. He was a well-known grandson of a former general. People knew his name. And he had obviously a personal axe to grind. Now, this is the rebellion in around 209 BC, mm-hmm. after the Dazishang Rebellion, which gets crushed. A point to anyone watching, it never pays to be the first rebel in Chinese history, certainly, and perhaps in other contexts. First one usually gets crushed. And Xiang Yu has this negative vision. He wants to see Chu restored. He wants vengeance for his grandfather, as opposed to Liu Bang, whose motivations are very different. And by this time, of course, we talked about in the other video, the Qin dynasty was no longer legalist. It was legalist in only name only. At the top, we have in court intrigues and eunuchs running the scene. So the time was ripe for rebellion. It's key to note that it didn't happen under Qin Shi Huang. No matter that these nobles had grudges, they bided their time and waited for weak leadership. And then Xiang Yu sprang into action.
And, you know, it's interesting what you said there about this is a guy who people would follow. Because, you know, Bertrand de Juvenal, he has this book called On Power, but he's got a much less lesser-known second book called The Pure Theory of Politics, or The Pure Theory of Power. And his formula for politics is literally, he was like, if you boil it down to its absolute essence, what is it? And he says, when a man moves another man. That's literally the formula. When A has the power to move B. It sounds small, but it's actually really quite significant. And I've been saying this you know, in recent days, when the Ayatollah was able to turn out a million people in Tehran. Now, you could scoff at it, but try getting a million people out in the streets, right? So this is quite a significant thing what that you mentioned with this chap, that his name meant something and people would be willing. If he said, go here, and people went there, that is political power right there, you know.
He was certainly recorded as an archetypical lion, in maybe a different sense from how I talked about the legalists who, and this is something I forgot to mention in the last lesson, throughout Chinese history, in the last video, throughout Chinese history, there's a certain squeamishness towards using violence within the landed gentry. They'd prefer to get some soldier to do it. So I frame them as lions in the sense that they were willing to use force, but someone else to do it via the laws. Xiang Yu, on the other hand, is an archetypical lion. He's recorded as being brave. He's recorded as being physically intimidating, a big man, a warrior, and he certainly could lead people. And that's what he did. He led thousands of Chu restorationists against overwhelming forces at the Battle of Julu. At the same time, I should mention that Liu Bang, on the other hand, was a very different type of leader, a delegator, someone who drew people to him, who had various motivations, and a lot of them were of the former elites that had been crushed under the Qin dynasty, but their vision was quite different. They wanted to build rather than destroy. And they actually...
Oh, so sorry. Carry on.
They actually allied with Xiang Yu at the Battle of Dingtao. So you see that this commonly happens in history. The builders hiding under the tree branches the safety net of the populists for the time being, allying with them for the time being, whilst they their power is smaller, they have less soldiers, but they have a common enemy. That's the Qin state.
Mm-hmm. Now, what interests me here, James, is that this lion figure that you're mentioning can't help but note that he seems to be on the wrong side. You said it's the Chu Han contention. I don't know that much about Chinese history, but I know enough to know that the Han win. So our lion loses here.
They did. He did. Yeah. And there's many reasons for that. And I think the main one is that he purely wants revenge. He doesn't see beyond that. And as I mentioned, he allies with Liu Bang at the Battle of Dingtao and eventually would fight them at Julu, vastly outnumbered with 70,000 of his own warriors against hundreds of thousands, perhaps, and defeats them. And he goes on to make two very rash decisions after this, and this will explain why he would eventually meet his downfall. He goes on to, it is said, bury alive hundreds of thousands of Qin soldiers in a ravine. Now, I'm not sure whether I believe this, but his later actions make sense in light of this as being a man purely after revenge. He does mm-hmm. not take the seat of power. The Qin dynasty sprung out of the west of China. It was a safe geographic territory from which to launch attacks to the east, whilst itself being a ringed off, it had mountains all around it. So if you want to take power, that's the place where you go to. But of course, if we remember, Xiang Yu doesn't want to restore the Qin dynasty. He doesn't want to continue it. He just wants to destroy it. So he takes the name of the hegemon of Western Chu, goes back to his former territory in Pengcheng in the east, and rules from there. And the story goes that some civil servants go to him and say, Xiang Yu, what are you doing? You've got the power, you can take it, but you're not ruling. You just want to see the past restored. And mm-hmm. supposedly he sends them off and kills these civil servants. That's all he wants. He just wants to restore his country. And he saw it happen in a way. He got what he wanted. But Liu Bang, on the other hand, as I may have mentioned in the previous video, he's been fighting for his life the whole time. He rebelled because he would have been punished by the Qin dynasty because of his failure to escort convicts to the capital. He's been fighting for his life the whole time, and he's fighting a very different battle from Xiang Yu. His pretext for attacking Xiang Yu after they were allies is that Xiang Yu holds his parents captive. Of course, they were both men of Chu from the south. Liu Bang calls his bluff and attacks. Xiang Yu's allies leave him when they realize that he's not a man of vision. He doesn't want to move forward in the future. He just wants to bring back the past. And they turn over to Liu Bang and ally with him instead.
I mean, it's hard not to think. I mean, again, you should always be wary of reading the present back into the past. They call it presentism in historiography. But it's not difficult to think of this as a kind of progressive versus a reactionary. In today's context, I mean, one of them's got a vision of what they want to do.
Mm.
And the other one seems to be just purely reactionary and out ultimately for revenge.
Yeah, absolutely. Xiang Yu didn't want to build anything. He just wanted to go back. We've got echoes of this in our own time. We have people talking mm-hmm. about restoring things to a state where they were in an idealized past. This vision, whilst necessary, cannot build the future. It just can't. For the characteristics, the very definition of what it is, it's a thing that wants to bring back the past. It can't bring forward the future.
Interesting. So does that mean, I hate to put it in such crude terms, but Does that mean the progressive is always destined to win because he's got a kind of rosy picture of the future?
I suppose it's more that someone with a positive vision is destined to win, and someone also, and I should have mentioned this before, someone who brings around themselves elite people. And that's what Liu Bang did. He brought with him people like Xiao He, who was a former magistrate of the Qin dynasty. He allied with Liu Bang. Zhang Liang, who was his chief strategist in the end, was a aristocrat of the destroyed Han state, different Han from the Han that Liu Bang would found. He was an aristocrat of the destroyed Han state. And also Han Xin was a noble, that's his chief general. He was an aristocrat of the former Han state as well. And all these people influenced Liu Bang eventually into bringing about Confucian ideals in governance. So I'd say it's a combination of having a positive vision and having elite people around you.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. But I mean, I hesitate. This is why it's so nonsensical in a way to sometimes try to read the present back onto the past. Because what I know of Confucianism, it is quite an inherently kind of conservative doctrine. Is that correct? Respect your elders, have respect for the law, act in a moral way, promotes hard work. Is this correct?
Yeah, I think by and large that's true. In the Analects of Confucius, this is something he talks about a lot. I suppose they're approaching different questions. Legalism is about how to govern, and Confucianism is how to be a moral person, how to be good as an individual. And I suppose they're two questions that every one of us has to answer at the same time. One without the other, a pure utilitarian vision of how to govern leaves a person without a moral core. And just having a moral core without practicality means that you're not going to do anything. You're not going to do anything with it. You'll just perhaps go off like Lao Tzu into the mountains.
Yes. Yeah, and that was one of my issues when I was reading Lao Tzu. It's like, it's all well and good for you, mate. I'm married and I've got a kid here. Your obligations, I can't just bugger off. Yeah. Oh yeah, be as the fish in the river. I was like, well, okay, right, but I also I got a mortgage. You know what I mean? Yeah, it's kind of like, it's kind of, there's a limit to how practical it is, to an extent. So,
The irony is that Confucius saw himself as bringing about the Tao. In governance, he used the word Tao in his writings a lot, and how to follow the way. There are recordings of them actually meeting in the records of the Grand Historian by Sima Qian. And as the story goes, Confucius meets Lao Tzu, and Lao Tzu says, what are you doing trying to change things? We're living in the times where things are out of kilter. Everything's topsy-turvy and upside down. What's the point in trying to make a difference? Well, Confucius goes, well, you have your way. You have your way, the way of water, and that's fine for you. But I got to live in the real world. And actually, Confucius, in his own life, was a political revolutionary. In the state of Liu, this was back in 500 BC now, he noticed that the nominal duke of his state, Duke Ding, actually it didn't hold power. There were three shadow elite families behind him who actually ran things. And he tried to pull the curtain out to make everyone see them by taking away their rights to have walls in their power bases, their towns, their cities that they held. He made that the law. He tried to say, well, you can't have your own walls. You don't need them. Our state, our Duke Ding, will protect you. This put them into a position of, well, they either go along with what Confucius is saying and lose their power, or go against the Duke. So he put them in a position of exposure by doing that. So within his own life, Confucius was, in fact, a noticer, one might say. but unfortunately, a failed one. It didn't go to plan.
Yeah. You know, I mean, not to get off on too much of a tangent, but in the Tao Te Ching, there are a few passages on governance, and they basically end up as kind of like libertarianism. I mean, it's basically like, oh, the good ruler is the one who has a very light touch and doesn't get too involved and kind of lets the people get on and work type thing. And it's like a very, like, it's basically like it just, to my eyes, it was like, yeah, this is just libertarianism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I can see why. Yeah. I can see why that would come across like that. And it certainly did. And I mean, Lao Tzu himself lived a life of a libertarian. I suppose we should hesitate to call him that, because he certainly wouldn't see himself as that. He would see himself as just being like water, following the Tao, following the way. But at the same time, one cannot go off into the mountains and just live. Where did Lao Tzu get his food from? Well, where did he get his tools from? From the state, from people who are producing it down in the valleys. Even monks cannot just survive by themselves. They need tools and things. And as the story goes with Lao Tzu, he just disappears off into the ether and no one sees him again. And I suppose that's the very point. One either chooses that life, and that's a choice one can make. And in times as topsy-turvy as ours, as upside down as ours, or one can try and take a stand and do something. I'd say they're both valid reactions to things. It's just, I don't see the point, I suppose, of one attacking the other. They're both mutually compatible ideals. The legalist needs the Confucian to consolidate things and keep things going and have some kind of amelioration to his pure ideals and of punishing anyone regardless of who they are. Confucius himself speaks of the importance of putting family first. And that's something that legalism would never do. It would never advocate for putting family first. But this is a real thing that we all feel. We all feel a natural tendency to put our family first. That doesn't mean we put others down necessarily. Mm. Like, one could be an Olympic athlete in the Olympics and want to win, want one's own family and country to do well without necessarily wanting others to fall. So I see all these legalism, Confucianism and Taoism as one can live the positives of all of these thought processes out in one's own life. Absolutely. They're just approaching different questions.
Yeah, without getting too like personal and esoteric, I mean, for me, I think I just have naturally a lot of fire right in me, and I'm also someone who's tended towards structure and like making spreadsheets and things like that. So for me, the Tao, when I was into it, was like a counterbalance against my natural tendency, because I'm naturally probably not like that. So it kind of helps you balance out, or you know, stop you going too much one way. And that is what, you know, personally, what I found kind of appealing in it. But you can't, I mean, it can't give you the total answer for the reasons that we've said. You've got to live in the real world too, you know.
In my experience, that's true. When I read the Tao Te Ching, I certainly get a lot of benefit from it. And I suppose there's an irony to it, but when one is in the middle of, let's say, a speech or something, or let's say a big important moment in one's life where one talks about these things like legalism or very harsh punishments and strong rewards, one may in fact be very mindful in that moment and be very in the zone. There's an irony to this, in that perhaps at that moment, you know, in 500, 350 BC, when Shanyang's writing the Book of Lord Shang, perhaps he's thinking, look at all this war that's been going on for hundreds of years, hundreds of thousands of people dying. This is a nightmare for no reason. We're all the same people. We need to unify. And he just thinks he's mindful in the moment. He's thinking about, how do we do that? Well, we need strong rewards and harsh punishments, I'm afraid. And that is the fact, that is the thing that unified the states. It's how it worked. Some people can retcon things and say, well, you know, it would have happened eventually. Well, not necessarily. Without Shanyang, I mean, that's how it happened, right? We often think about the dominoes lined up against each other. Without Shanyang writing that book and without reforming the state of Qin, you don't get the unification. You don't get the end of the Warring States period. You get an endless warring between the people who see themselves as the same. What's the sense in that?
Mm-hmm. Just to come back to, you know, we're getting right up to the point where the Han dynasty is established, and then when the Han state is established. How exactly does all this resolve? And I know we've touched on it already, but let's just get us right up to that moment.
All right. So Liu Bang has this very capable elite around him. They defeat Xiang Yu at the Battle of Gaisha. Xiang Yu goes down in flames because he's fighting a different battle from Liu Bang. And Liu Bang, even at this very early stage, he begins to show that he's a man of vision. He builds the Weiyang Palace. The Weiyang Palace in modern-day Xi'an, back then it was called Xianyang. And that's the administrative center. It would come to be the administrative center of the next 800 years of Chinese history, going all the way to the Sui dynasty. I mean, talk about a legacy. So this is to remind ourselves that people out there thinking of building things, even now, as Liu Bang did, building the Weiyang Palace. And I should mention that I know people in these circles doing things that are good like this, for example, in the Pendragon Foundation. They're thinking about, they're looking to the future, building things once more. Because that speaks to this positive vision that Liu Bang would eventually have and founded with the Han Dynasty. And as I mentioned, he did before, he didn't take back the legalist code. But what he did do, I suppose, is ameliorate some of the extremities of it. He rewarded his friends, for example, the people who rose up with him in rebellion and founded the Han Dynasty would be dukes and feudal loyal dukes to him. And the Han Dynasty lasted with an interregnum of Wang Mang in around, I think off the top of my head, 23 AD. 400 years. And that's where we get Han ethnicity from now. 90% of modern day Chinese people call themselves Han. It's a legacy of this man, Liu Bang. Because that spirit that I mentioned earlier, that spirit of vengeance, dies with Xiang Yu. What grudge do the former nobles have against Liu Bang? None. He comes about and destroys the hated order and brings about 400 years of, well, I didn't know that at the time, I suppose, but he brings about Pax Sinica. That's what we know it as today.
Mm. Yeah, interestingly, this is something Shakespeare goes into, which is how do you break a cycle of violence? How do you break a cycle of revenge? Obviously in Shakespeare's time they were just coming out with the War of the Roses, or is in recent memory, so it was constantly something that was on their minds. How do you stop it? How do you you know, how do you get out of it? And I mean, his conclusion is that somebody somewhere has to forgive somebody, or they're all dead, or in this case, they're all dead. They're
yeah. All dead. or perhaps it's with sacrifice. It's with sacrifice. Mm-hmm. The reformer, Lord Xiang, would have to die for his laws to come into being, because he takes the resentment of the nobles with him. They don't repeal the laws. They don't mm-hmm. repeal the standardization. They don't repeal the meritocratic rewards that they're going to give everyone, all the soldiers, for doing well in battle, and punishments for people doing the crime. And also another sacrifice with Xiang Yu. I don't think that the Chu restorationist that I mentioned, he has to go down. And I made a video about this, and I actually came to very, almost in spite of myself, identify very strongly with Xiang Yu. I understand him, why he had to bring about vengeance. He had to do it. He had to do it for his state. He had to do it for his grandfather. And by doing this, he gives a path for Liu Bang. Because Liu Bang, you see, he can stay clean through this whole process. He doesn't look like the awful one who buries the hundreds of thousands of soldiers and does all the dirty work. He can stay clean. He relies on Xiang Yu to do this. He cannot have a path without Xiang Yu, because as we know, people will still side with the regime no matter how awful it is, for a variety of reasons. It could be because their very position relies on its continued existence, mm-hmm. or they're like the corrupt eunuch Zhao Gao, they benefit from it. Or loyalty, misplaced loyalty. It could be they feel an attachment and affinity to the ruling dynasty, in spite of the fact that it's rotten. So what I'm trying to say is that sometimes sacrifice is the answer. And I mean, we know that from history. We know that in ourselves as well. When we give up something in our life, whether that be a bad habit, whether that be something we want to change, it often brings about fruits. And that's what happened with Xiang Yu and Liu Bang, those two key characters there. One does not get a Han dynasty without a sacrifice of Xiang Yu. Now, I don't know whether... Sorry, go on.
I was just going to say, it's just a fascinating perspective to think about it in this way. Even though he lost, he kind of did a service in a way in his defeat.
Yeah. I don't know whether he was aware of it, of what he was doing. The records suggest, and this goes back to Sima Qian, who's writing in 90 BC, so around about 200 years after the event. So you know, we could debate the fact of whether or not this happened, but the fact is this is how it's recorded. And there's a story being drawn out here that we know happened. We know happens in history, even when things are more effectively recorded by people at the time. We know this kind of thing happens. We see it with our eyes. We can see how it happens. So I'm not sure whether Xiang Yu actually knew what he was doing, but he certainly gave a path for Liu Bang. I mean, we talk about having a garden and one having to remove old growth to get new growth. And that the person who removes that old growth will look the bad guy. They will appear to be the immoral one. But they take mm-hmm. that hit, perhaps for someone like Liu Bang.
Very interesting.
Couldn't have happened without him.
Very interesting indeed. Well, you're going to join us a third time, James, to talk about the Han dynasty, or at least the early part of it. This has been... very interesting. I didn't know a lot of this stuff. I didn't know about this little period that you're talking about here. Because, I mean, when you're dealing with such vast time spans, you tend to like leap from see the highlights, right? It's like, oh, it's Qin, then it's Han. And it's, you don't think about like how it actually gets there. So it's very interesting. Where can people find you, James?
I'm James Eno on Twitter, and I mentioned that Pendragon.foundation earlier. If you want to build something, put seeds down for the positive vision in the future for the civilizational spring, perhaps, they can be found there. So yeah, those are my two links on Twitter.
And yeah, you can pick up a course at Academic Agency, promo code Shorjan, and we'll catch you all next time. If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the Academic Agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.